Martian Drive-In Podcast 126. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, I'm looking at something old and something new. The old thing is from 1961, and it is The Phantom Planet, starring Dean Fredericks and Colleen Gray. And then we move to 2017 for Guillermo del Toro's most recent film, which has been nominated for 13 Academy Awards, The Shape of Water, starring Sally Hawkins, Richard Jenkins, and Doug Jones. So it's going to be a lot of fun, and there are actually things that are in common between these two films, which I didn't quite realise when I was putting together this podcast. So sit back, I will get the contact details out of the way, and we can start talking about spaceships and Gillmen. Martian Drive-In Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of science fiction, horror, fantasy, film appreciation. It doesn't matter when it comes from, whether it's old or new, in black and white, in colour, 3D, anamorphic. It doesn't matter. If it's interesting, I'm going to give it a go. Now, there are occasionally also roundtable discussions where I get a few like-minded cronies around and we talk about science fiction or horror or fantasy or anything that takes our mind. So the format's kind of loose. Now, you can contact me and leave feedback via feedbackpaleo, that's feedback, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and have a chat there with me and other people about science fiction, fantasy, horrors, or any other kind of things you want to talk about. Apart from politics, I've got another area for that. Please be aware that this podcast does have swearing in it. So if you're going to be listening to it on speakers, make sure there are no children around, unless you want them to learn wider vocabulary than they already have. Okay, people, how have you been? It's been very hot and humid here, which makes me nostalgic for Darwin, to be honest with you. But for Melbourne, at this time of year, it does get humid and really, really hot, like 105 degrees Fahrenheit hot. And then suddenly we get storms and then it drops down to like 70 degrees Fahrenheit. It's crazy around here. Totally bug fuck. It's only a fairly recent phenomenon too, so climate change is real. I don't know whether I mentioned this, but when I was in Tasmania, a friend of the podcast, Kerry Lanahan, gave Sally and I a bit of a tour around the Tasmania Botanical Gardens in Hobart, because that's what he does. And there's so much evidence just in the way trees are reacting to climatic changes in Tasmania for climate change. There's irrefutable evidence because you can point to it and see it. So the physical changes in the trees reflect much wider changes in our environment. So that's kind of cool and kind of tragic at the same time. So things are going crazy. Climate extremes are happening. Weird shit is coming down the pike every fucking day because of all sorts of things, including Trump, of course. But it's very hot and humid here. Well, the weather's going to break in, I think, about 7 or 8 hours, so we'll get things cooling down again. But at the moment, it's very hot and humid. I've got the air conditioning on full, so there's a bit of background noise from the air conditioner. But I do have some filters I can use to kind of minimize that. So if for some reason my voice sounds a little tiniest bit tinny, it's not necessarily me. It could just be the filter I use to get rid of the background hum from the full bore dialed up to 11 air conditioning that we have in the house at the moment. So I've got to mention this. Ursula K. Le Guin died. Fantastic science fiction writer. Also, in a sense, a fantastic philosopher. She was instrumental in giving Australian science fiction writing a boost in 1975, where she came over here for a writer's workshop for a number of people. And and apparently well regarded by everybody. There is only one real, the two real adaptations of her work are The Lathe of Heaven, which was done as a PBS television thing back in, I think, the 70s. Let me just double check that, because that's what I do. And this is so interesting. 1979. And that's currently up on YouTube, so you can watch that. There was also Tales of Ursi, which was done by Hayao Miyazaki's son, Goro. And I haven't seen that, but I really should visit it. I know that Le Guin wasn't particularly happy with some aspects of it,
but there are rarely writers who are happy with any kind of visual adaptation of their work. If you haven't read any Le Guin, you really should do it. Start with something like The Left Hand of Darkness or The Dispossessed or any one of the Earthsea books if you're more fantasy inclined. But she'll be missed, and she was a tough woman, and that's always a nice thing. And I believe she was writing right up until close to her death. And I know she did some blog posts and some newspaper columns, and is one of the greats of the genre. And it is quite sad that somebody didn't invent immortality for people like Ursula Le Guin. So what have I been watching? Nothing as good as Le Guin, to be really honest with you. I've been trolling YouTube a lot, as I'm inclined to do. I did watch a couple of Olsen and Johnson comedies. Olsen and Johnson are kind of forgotten now. But on Broadway, they did this anarchic comedy thing called Hell's a Poppin', which was adapted to a movie in 1941 with Olsen and Johnson, of course, Martha Ray, Misha Hours in there as well, Elisha Cook Jr., Shemp Howard, a whole bunch of people, lots of visual gags. And Hell's a Poppin's definitely an influence on Zaz, you know, Zucker Abrams, Zucker, and all of those kind of guys who did things like Airplane and other movies were directly influenced by Olsen and Johnson. So I watched Hell's a Poppin'. I also started to watch Country Gentleman, which is a shorter film they did before Hell's a Poppin', or maybe just after, but the copy on YouTube is pretty ropey, and I stopped watching it because I just couldn't, you know, the definition was too low to watch. So there's that. The other thing I watched, and I regret watching it, to be honest with you, is Transformers The Last Night. People have been talking about how bad this movie is for a little while now, so I watched it, and it's incredibly bad. It doesn't flow. There's no motivation. It goes from one action scene to another. There's tons of military shit in there because the American military backed them up by giving them access to military technology. So in Transformers movies, there's always tons of, you know, military technology porn. None of the characters are at all interesting or inspiring or even remotely human. And it's all just things bashing together pretty much. And it makes no sense, no logic, and it really, yeah, it makes a lot of, those things make a lot of money, but then so does cocaine. So I probably won't visit any more Transformers movies when they make them, unless they get something really interesting happening, which I very much doubt. But for certain guys, and it's overwhelmingly guys of certain ages, these movies are the bee's knees. But for me, nah. Yeah, nah, as we say here. So that's pretty much all I've been watching. I have kept up with a few TV series like Supergirl and The Flash and all that, and they're going in interesting directions, and they're a lot of fun to watch. And apart from that, not too much. I've just been kind of low-keying it. I really want to get more stuff done as far as YouTube and the podcasts are concerned. So that's primarily where my focus is going to be. But I'm looking forward to a number of movies coming up soon. We've got Black Panther coming up. I want to see Sweet Country, an Australian film, kind of an Australian Western, which is getting some really great reviews, and a number of other things. And, of course, I want to catch up with some more French New Wave movies that I haven't seen. So I've got that going. And there's also a French version of Beauty and the Beast done with Vincent Cassel and Léa Seydoux, which I picked up a copy of very, very cheaply the other day. And I want to watch that. Beauty and the Beast isn't my favourite story in the world, but I really want to see Cassel and Seydoux as the beauty, as the Beast and the Beauty. And I hear good things about it, so I'm going to check out that as well. I may even compare and contrast it with the definitive Beauty and the Beast, which is not the Disney one, but the version with Jean Marais done in the 1940s. I've got a copy of that, and I may compare and contrast them. I may even do it for the podcast. Let me know if you think that's a good idea, because both telling the same story, both from very different viewpoints in very different times using very different technologies. But I think I may well have a go at that, because it looks like it might be a bit of fun to do. And one of the things I want to do this year is make things fun. So that's about all I've been watching. Nothing really fantastic. There are a few things I started to watch, but then they got fucking boring, so I stopped, which is something I never did in the past. I'd watch anything under any circumstance. But for these days, I just go, no, this one's not grabbing me in the first 10 minutes. It doesn't have any kickers. It doesn't have any eyeball punches. It doesn't have anything really interesting. So, no. So there's a bit of that going on in my life at the moment. Nonetheless, I did see The Shape of Water, of course, and I decided I wanted to match it with something totally different because that's how I work this podcast, in case you're a new listener. And so I went with something that I saw as a child on television and enjoyed, which is the really Z-grade science fiction movie The Phantom Planet from 1961, which is a movie that was filmed a year before The Shape of Water was set, because The Shape of Water is set in 1962. So they're the two movies for the podcast. So I'm going to take a break now. And when I get back, I'm going to do these in chronological order. And we're going to take a look at a movie very much of its time, very much kind of C-grade science fiction, but nonetheless kind of interesting in some ways. And I kind of admire the filmmakers for the audacity of some parts of it and the fact that on limited budgets they tried to tell a fairly interesting and fairly big and slightly different story.
Since the splitting of the atom only a few decades ago, and through his God-given genius of science, man at last has succeeded in penetrating further and further into the unknown vastness of space. The moon has become the launching base for advanced exploration. From this pivotal point, astronauts, at the risk of their lives, set out to conquer nature's mysterious forces. Yet many questions remained unanswered. What is his Earth in relation to the inconceivable number of other worlds? Is his speed truly the fastest? His achievements the greatest? Or is he a mere unimportant piece of driftwood floating in the vast ocean of the universe? Could there be life similar to our own on other planets? Is it not possible that atmospheric conditions of relative environments control their shapes and forms? If so, would they be giants? Or could perhaps the opposite be true? Could their intellect have reached a scientific level far above man's dreams? What then will the future reveal if this story you are about to witness is only the beginning?
I really like that kind of narration at the start of a science fiction film. It really sets it up for you, and it's bombastic and over the top. And far apart from the mention of a deity, it kind of works for me. And it's kind of questioning our place in the universe in a very kind of grandiose way. And for little kids watching the film, they kind of go, "Wow!" because it's the first time they've had an exposure to that kind of big concept in science fiction, and that's kind of cool. The Phantom Planet's not going to top anyone's list of great movies. The director, William Marshall, not William Blackula Marshall, but another William Marshall, was very much a kind of B-movie director. He did things, let's see, he was actually an actor as well as a director, but the things he directed were The Adventures of Captain Fabian, a movie called Hello, God, both of those in 1951, and The Phantom Planet. But he was mostly known as an actor and tended between 1940 and 1958. So he wasn't particularly well known as a director because he only did three things. He also wrote additional dialogue for The Phantom Planet, looking through this. But nonetheless, he does a pretty okay job, given the limitations of the budget, of course. Okay, the movie stars Dean Fredericks, who was an actor who did a few things. He did a TV series of Steve Canyon and spent a bit of his time playing Indigenous American characters in various TV episodes. So he never really did a lot of work that way. Then we got Colleen Gray, who had a bit more of a filmography. Interesting thing is she was 40 years old when she made this film and doesn't look anywhere near that. But you remember her from things like The Killing, with Kubrick's movie The Killing. She was in Kiss of Death with Victor Maturin, Brian Donlevy and Richard Widmark. She was in Red River. So she did a whole bunch of large films in the late 40s and early 1950s. Then we moved on to episodic TV. and ultimately, kind of faded out of a career apart from doing little bits on television. The last credit was an episode of Tales of the Dark Side, the TV series in 1986. But in this one, she plays Liana, an alien woman, because there are two alien women in this one, one of whom is mute, aphasic because of a childhood trauma. And that one is played by an actor called Dolores Faith, who didn't do terribly much stuff. She did a couple of episodes of The Man from She did an episode of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and some episodic TV, as a lot of people did. She was in The Human Duplicators, Honeymoon Hotel. I think that may have had Robert Goulet in it. Just let me double check. Yep, Robert Goulet, Nancy Quinn, and Robert Morse. So she was in that. And then she married one of the heirs to the Maxwell House coffee fortune and stopped making movies because why would you when you had that much money and your career wasn't really going anywhere? There are a couple of other interesting people in the film as well, and I've done some homework on a couple of them. Anthony Dexter, who played Valentino in a movie called Valentino, oddly enough, in 1951, because he did resemble Rudolph Valentino. Anthony Dexter had this really weird career change in the 1960s, where he stopped making movies because his career had stalled, and became a school teacher under another name in the Midwest of America, and became a drama teacher in a high school. And I've been looking around the web a little bit, and there are a lot of people who went to that high school who remember him well and said that his teaching of them in the drama class helped them build their own self-confidence and their own personalities. And he was incredibly well-regarded for that. So that's kind of cool too. He did a total kind of not tree change in a sense and became a whole other person and went on to be very influential and very important in the lives of developing human beings. Very cool. The other person worth noting in this movie is a guy called Francis X. Bushman, an older actor at the time, who was the original Ben-Hur in the 1920s version of Ben-Hur, the one that way predates the Charlton Heston version and definitely predates the one directed by Timur Bekmambetov very recently. Let's see, his Ben-Hur was, he was actually in Sabrina as well, with Bogart, William Holden, and Audrey Hepburn. He actually didn't play Ben-Hur, sorry, he played Messala in the original Ben-Hur. Raymond Navarro played Ben-Hur in the original Ben-Hur, my mistake. He played the role that Stephen Boyd played in the 1950s Ben-Hur, which is kind of cool. And he's got a very kind of stentorian and authoritarian voice, a kind of actor's theatrical voice. And it's kind of cool. He seems to be a little out of place compared to the other actors in the movie, but it's nice to see the guy getting work. I probably should at some stage, and now would be a good time, I suppose, mention what the fuck the movie is about. And here's a synopsis from IMDb by Anonymous. The mysterious appearance of an unknown planet brings miniature people, giant monsters, beautiful women, and undaunted heroes to the screen. The self-contained planet Reton has the ability to move in and out of galaxies to escape the enemies. That's a really fucked up number. No wonder the person didn't put their name against it, because there are about 15 different errors in that first sentence. Let me try to see if I can find us a better synopsis for this film, because it deserves it. Let's see. After an invisible asteroid draws an astronaut and his ship onto its surface, he is miniaturized by the Phantom Planet's exotic atmosphere. That pretty much covers it. Dean Fredericks plays an astronaut who is out patrolling space the way that astronauts did in the 1960s. And he and his partner, who soon dies off in a way very reminiscent of one of the astronauts in 2001 A Space Odyssey, which postdates this movie, so maybe Phantom Planet was an influence on Kubrick there. He lands on the planet, and because he starts breathing the atmosphere of the planet, it shrinks him down to about 6 inches high because all of the inhabitants of this asteroid, which looks like nothing so much as a hot and spicy KFC chicken wing with all the crusty coating on it. So anyway, he shrinks down and he meets the people who live on the planet who have got technology way beyond ours, even in this weird future year of 1980 in which the movie is set. They have control of gravity, which is kind of nice. They can move their asteroid around like a spaceship, which is even cooler. But unfortunately, they have enemies, because you've got to have enemies in this kind of thing. And the only enemies in this case are called Solarites. And the only Solarite we really see is played by a guy who became famous in really shitty James Bond film starring Roger Moore, and that's Richard Kiel playing as the Solarite. But people knew him as Jaws in those really shitty Roger Moore James Bond films that people who are younger than me seem to like for some obscure reason. So this is Richard Kiel's first role in a feature film, which is kind of cool, though you don't get to see him at all because he's got this thing that looks like a scrotum on top of his head and big buggy eyes and a dog snout and claws with suction, or hands with suction cups on the end of them. And, he's not visible. They used him basically for his height and put this costume on him. The monster costume isn't terribly great, but in the context of this being kind of a slightly kiddie-oriented science fiction movie, it kind of works. You accept the fact that, yes, the alien's got a big scrotumy thing on his head, not unreminiscent of the Metaluna mutant in This Island Earth, and that at some stage it's going to escape and monster people. So, anyway, the astronaut, whose name I will mention as soon as I scroll up the IMDb page, Dean Ferrich plays Captain Frank Chapman, Captain Generic, first name, Generic, last name, who is not welcomed by the people of Riton, the asteroid, because he's somebody from elsewhere, of course. And he gets treated fairly shabbily. He ends up having a fight with a guy called Heron, played by Anthony Dexter, where they have to push each other onto gravity plates, which you've got like super gravity on them, which will basically disintegrate anything that goes onto the plate. They have a fight, but when Chapman wins, he decides he's not going to kill Heron, and they end up being buddies. And of course, the gravity plates come into play when the Solarite escapes and starts monstering the character played by Dolores Faith, whose name is, and there are generic names for people in this kind of thing, Zetha. For some reason, her name is Zetha. So you get that. You also get her finding her voice again, because the traumatic shock of nearly seeing Dean Fredericks killed by the monster for some reason makes her non-aphasic, because any kind of psychological trauma can be cured by another psychological trauma in movie talk. But I'm kind of dissing this movie a little bit, but it kind of works for me. They didn't get the science right at all, but they made an attempt to. The spaceship interiors had some cool diesel punky looking instrumentation. The spacesuits were pretty much high altitude pressure suits that were worn by pilots at the time. So they've got those kind of ridges, and the helmets are kind of cool in there. They've got a couple of enlarged props as well. They've got an enormous helmet for when Dean Frederick shrinks down to the size of the other people, so we've got that going for it. The exterior of the spaceship looks kind of cool and works well, so they actually made a lot of effort to, if not get the science right, get the science plausible for this movie. And for its time, it was good honest drive-in fodder. You weren't going to be terribly scared by the monsters, you weren't going to be in love with the hero very much, and there are some attractive looking women wandering around and lots of kind of pseudo-scientific dialogue in there, but nonetheless, it kind of works for me for some reason. Maybe because I saw it at a very impressionable age. That's never to be discounted. It's the reason why people, some people, to be fair to everybody, want Star Wars movies to stay the way they were in the 1970s and early 1980s, because you've got that locked-in nostalgia for a film which makes you forgive its sins and kind of inclines you towards liking it, even if it isn't very good. And that, for me, is a very interesting phenomenon, that kind of locking in of an affinity for either a series or an individual film. There was a thing somewhere on the internet, and you can find this yourself because you've got Google, where they let millennials watch early James Bond movies, and all of them decided that Sean Connery was a rapist. And You can see that argument. I mean, yeah, there are times where he kisses women who seem reluctant, and then they give in to him with great ardor, which was a trope at the time, but didn't really happen in real life. But nonetheless, in spite of that stuff, I liked the early James Bond films. Not because of the machismo of the actor and the fact that he kisses women who seem reluctant and seduces them, but because of a lot of other things and a lot of cool stuff. I like the early James Bond films. I like because they're period pieces now, so you get a little bits of what Jamaica was like in the 1960s and other places as well. You get to see in Goldfinger what a Kentucky Fried Chicken looked like at the time and all that kind of stuff. And I like Connery. I like the character actors in there. I like the suspense and the tension and all that kind of thing. The romance is neither here nor there, even though there are incredibly attractive women in there. And the male gaze is definitely in place. I like them. So we like a lot of films in spite of their flaws and in spite of the fact that there is no way they'd be made the same way now as they were then, a thing which The Phantom Planet definitely has. There's no way somebody would make a science fiction movie like this without their tongue in their cheek at all 2 decades into the 21st century. But in a sense, you look at them as historical documents in a way, and they're entertainments of their time. Though there are a lot of younger people in particular that really can't wear older films because they can't get past the fact that it's not a film with the same moral compass as we have now, or as we should have now, in fact. But I think they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater a bit by doing that, because if you can't get past your own preconceptions, you're going to miss out on a lot of good cinema. I mean, I understand where they're coming from with that. There's a movie called Follow Me, Boys, which is a Disney live-action film with Kurt Russell in it from the 1960s, which I have trouble watching because of my own family history. But I wouldn't say that people shouldn't watch it, and I wouldn't say that it was fucked up for that reason. And also, things like Song of the South, the Disney movie, which is racist as fuck. People want it released so they can show how people perceive things at the time and how we've moved on since then. One of the nice things about older films, which have a lot of stuff which is repugnant to a lot of people in modern times, and I'm drifting off the subject here, I realise, is that you can see the progress we've made since that time. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But there are people whose perceptions can't see past their own moral code for now. I understand it and I respect that opinion. I don't share it in all cases. But there are people who have real problems with movies like this one, where a character who's mute is not played by an actor who is mute. As indeed, some people have made that argument about the second film I'm going to talk about, The Shape of Water, because Sally Hawkins, who plays Eliza, the main character in that, is not a person who's unable to speak in real life. And there are people with disabilities who find that very, very problematic. And while I understand that and while I respect it to a certain extent, I think that we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater to a certain extent, because a lot of these films have a lot of positive things, particularly when I'm going to talk about The Shape of Water. I'll talk about what those positive things are. But just focusing tightly on one aspect, which is very personal for some people, one aspect of a film, and dismissing the whole film based on that one aspect of it, is maybe not the way to enjoy what essentially should be entertainment for you. If you don't like that kind of film, definitely don't see it, and make your opinion known by all means. But I think there's more to a film than a bad piece of casting in some cases. It's like I spoke about The Great Wall last podcast, where a lot of people said that there was a lot of kind of whitewashing of characters in that. But it turned out that that wasn't necessarily the case, and that the characters were there for a specific reason, and the characters who weren't white people were shown to be even more adept in a lot of cases than the white actors. So there wasn't the white savior narrative in those. I think that having more inclusive and more interesting films by casting people who have certain disabilities to play characters with those disabilities is something we should do much, much more of in the future. I agree. And hopefully there'll be a normalization of people with disabilities in cinema in the future. But one of the things that it takes a certain amount of skill to do is to not let that become stunt casting, where you go, hey, look at us, we've got somebody with an intellectual disability playing somebody with an intellectual disability and they're doing it great, where the story for the film isn't necessarily about that disability and that they are a character who, if we let it, would kind of skew the narrative in ways not intended. So there's got to be a balance there, and it takes a lot of skill to do it. I think Breaking Bad definitely did it with the son of the Walter White character who had a disability. There are a whole bunch of other movies that do it well, but I think there's missing movies like The Phantom Planet and The Shape of Water because there's a character with a disability not played by an actor with a disability isn't the only thing about the movie. The movies are much more than that, less so with The Phantom Planet, which is just an old entertainment from the 1960s. But with The Shape of Water, there are a lot of things being said there which are useful enough and important enough that while we acknowledge that Sally Hawkins' character is mute and is played by an actor who doesn't have that disability, there's a lot being said in that movie that's important and needs to be heard. But just to wind up on The Phantom Planet, it's a bit of fun. It's very much of its time, but I find it kind of cute and quaint now. But rewatching it, I did enjoy it, and I liked the fact that they tried to do some interesting things. They tried to do an enormous space battle on a limited budget with limited effects, and they didn't fail entirely, and that's kind of cool. They didn't have the technological breakthroughs that ILM put out in the 1970s to help them, so they did what they could with what they had, and it was quite fun watching them do that. It's a bit like watching George Méliès' Trip to the Moon movie. It's in no way realistic, but it's quaint and amusing and entertaining, and it shows people trying to stretch the medium as they had it then with the resources they had at the time. And for me, The Phantom Planet does that. It's a lot of fun. It's a good, honest 1960s science fiction movie, and I like it. I've got a soft spot for it in my heart. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and then I'm going to talk about Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, a movie nominated for 13 Academy Awards, which has a lot to say about the times in which we live.
You clean that lab, you get out.
She deaf?
Mute, sir. She can hear you.
The thing we keep in there is an affront. And I should know, I dragged it all the way here.
Help!
It's a lot of blood. What went on in here?
It was you that found my fingers. There was mustard on them.
The Soviets want it. We know that much.
Need to take it apart, learn how it works.
What happened?
It's an animal, just keeping it tame.
Unichtojish.
I can either save him or let him die.
Don't do this, Eliza. Don't do this.
I'm gonna be synchronizing our watches just like they do in the movies.
Oh, woman, we gonna burn in hell.
Do you have it?
No!
Sure, I'm getting it back.
Our concern is the Russians.
And fuck this mess.
You delivered, right? Right?
We didn't see nothing.
What am I doing? Interviewing the shit cleaners.
He's a wild creature. We can't ask him to be anything else.
You were speaking Russian, Bob! Oh!
Sit down!
Finish the job, son.
Eliza, honey, he's coming for you.
The Shape of Water is a 2017 American fantasy drama film directed by Guillermo del Toro and written by del Toro and Vanessa Taylor. Film stars Sally Hawkins, Michael Shannon, Richard Jenkins, Doug Jones, Michael Stuhlbarge, and Octavia Spencer. It's set in Baltimore in 1962, and it follows a mute custodian in a high-security government lab who befriends a captured humanoid amphibian creature. So that's it from Wikipedia. So, yeah, Del Toro has had a fascination with amphibian humanoid creatures since he saw Creature from the Black Lagoon. He really, he actually did propose to Universal Studios that he do a remake of the Creature from the Black Lagoon, doing things more from the creature's viewpoint. They knocked it back, and they were maybe uncomfortable with the fact that he wanted the relationship between the creature and its human love interest to be much more than it was in the Creature from the Black Lagoon with the Gill Man and Julie Adams. Del Toro has said that he wanted to set the film during the 1960s Cold War to counteract today's heightened tensions. He said, "If I say once upon a time in 1962, it becomes a fairy tale for troubled times. People can lower their guard a little bit more and listen to the story and listen to the characters and talk about the issues rather than the circumstances of the issues." He also said that the movie is a healing movie for me. "For 9 movies, I rephrased the fears of my childhood, the dreams of my childhood, and this is for the first time, and this I speak for the first time as an adult, about something that worries me as an adult. I speak about trust, otherness, sex, love, and where we're going. These are not concerns that I had when I was 9 or 7. So, in a sense, it's a very personal film for Del Toro, and he did partly finance it himself. The budget on the movie was crazy low for this kind of film, particularly for one which is getting such high critical regard. It's only $19.5 million to make this movie, and it's already made $51.9 million. But as the Oscar buzz increases, of course, more and more bums are going to get on more and more seats, and the movie will become more profitable. So from here on out, I'm going to get spoilery with this movie. I'll just go through the cast and the characters that they play and then talk about why the movie works so well and why I really enjoyed it. So we have the English actor Sally Hawkins playing Eliza Esposito, an orphan who was found by the water, kind of like Moses in a sense, I suppose, and who has scar tissues that look like gills on her neck. It's not really made clear why she has those scars there. I'm going to give you my interpretation of it, which is the fact that she actually was born with gills. And as happens with children who are intersex, surgery was done to mutilate her, in a sense, and to close up the gills. That's my theory, anyway, based on the events towards the rear end of the movie. May not be accurate, but a lot of this movie is oblique, and interpretation is the way to go with it. So that's my theory, is that she is some kind of water creature, and she's not entirely human. That's my spin on it. So we have her as that. She works in a secret government facility as a cleaner. So she's kind of at the low end of both the hierarchy in where she works and the socioeconomic scale. Her boss, who comes in with the monster into this facility, which is a secret scientific research base, is a guy called Colonel Richard Strickland, played by Michael Shannon at his worst. Best worst. Michael Shannon, fantastic actor, and he's willing to go into the heart of darkness of the male human soul, and very much does so in this movie. His character is the poster boy for toxic masculinity in a number of ways, and I'll explain more of that about that in a moment. Then we have Richard Jenkins as the guy who lives in the flat next to Eliza's. His name is Giles, and he is a commercial artist, a very good commercial artist, an older guy, and he is gay. Now, people have said in various reviews that he was closeted, but in 1962 America, unless you were a Noel Coward, then you didn't have the choice of not being closeted, in a sense. There were certain people who chose to live their lives openly, but they were at risk of police harassment, of blackmail, of losing their jobs, and there's a strong implication in this movie that Giles lost his job with an advertising agency as a commercial artist, and there are a couple of efforts he makes to get that job back. Because he was gay and may have had a relationship with somebody else at the office. So that's a fairly strong implication made by the script of this movie. And Richard Jenkins is very good as that character as well. He plays him as kind of uncertain, but in a sense true to himself in a way. He has this infatuation with the young guy who works at a franchise pie store nearby. And he goes and buys pies he doesn't want so he can spend a little time with this guy. He's a lonely, older, gay guy in a world that doesn't have sympathy for any of those things. Then we have Doug Jones as the amphibian man. Doug Jones is the go-to guy. At the moment, he's playing Saru in Star Trek Discovery and giving us a really interesting, nuanced and articulate non-human creature. And Doug Jones is the kind of Lon Chaney of our age. He really does have the chops. Him and Andy Serkis basically are the two go-to guys to play aliens or non-human creatures in any movie that you've got, and he does a really good job of it. As a physical actor, there's nobody quite his equal, and in this one the body language of his amphibian man is really great, and also the special effects work to make his costume is fantastic. One of the things that Del Toro said is he wanted the monster to have a great ass. And indeed, the monster does have a great male ass in this movie. Then we've got other characters we've got in the movie. We've got Michael Stuhlbarge playing Dr. Robert Hofstetter, who is actually a Russian spy working in the center as well. And the interesting thing that Del Toro and Vanessa Taylor do with this movie is make the Russian spy a sympathetic character. He betrays his own side of things because it's the right thing to do and because he's a scientist first and a human being first and the politics come second. And that's kind of interesting. And I really like the way that that's played in this movie. And Michael Stuhlbarge is a fantastic actor as well. Then we have Octavia Spencer, who was in Hidden Figures, playing Zelda Fuller, who's a co-worker of Eliza's and who translates from American Sign Language to English when she needs to communicate with anybody at work. And there's a couple of good scenes with her in there. In a sense, she's a sounding board for Eliza and she's they're close friends. And Zelda is a hyperverbal person. She's unashamed in the way she talks to Eliza. She talks about her relationship with her husband. She talks about sex. She talks about everything in a very life-affirming way. And Octavia Spencer does a great job in this. And it's one of those roles that could be seen as a black person playing a secondary character in this. But I see the movie more as an ensemble. I think everybody is an integral part of what's happening in this film. And her, Zelda, has, even though she's kind of scared at various stages, particularly when Eliza decides she's going to kidnap the amphibian man and take him away from the research center, she tries to stop Eliza for that. But when she realizes how committed Eliza is in doing this, she embraces it wholeheartedly and finds her own courage in it, which is kind of cool. Then we've got Nick Searcy playing General Frank Hoyt. And again, another aspect of toxic masculinity in this film, in the sense that his general is a hard-ass kind of general and really pushes Strickland towards solving the problem of the lost monster before the shit hits the fan big time. Then we've got Canadian actor David Hewlett as Fleming, one of the other guys who works in the lab. He was almost unrecognizable. He looked a little bit like Bradley Whitford in this film, a younger Bradley Whitford. But people have seen him in a number of things. He was in Stargate SG-1, Stargate Atlantis, Stargate Universe. He was in Cube, Scanners 2, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. He's the guy that gave everybody the germ that fucked the world. And he's also been in a few films with Vincenzo Natali, the guy who directed, amongst other things, Cypher and Splice, and has been for a while, I don't know whether this is still a goer, working on an adaptation of Neuromancer for the screen. So I'm not sure whether that's going to happen, but Yeah, David Hewlett is good in this one as well. It's kind of very much a secondary role, but his Fleming is the kind of company man who really doesn't realise what's happening with Strickland. And that, of course, means that shit hits the fan. We've also got Lauren Lee Smith playing Elaine Strickland, Strickland's wife, who is a homemaker, because this is 1962 America, of course. Doesn't quite realise the kind of person she's married. Now, I've talked more about Michael Shannon Strickland now because he's an interesting character. During the film, he has his ring finger and his small finger of his left hand bitten off by the monster, but then he's been torturing it with a cattle prod for a while, so fair cops there. Eliza finds his fingers and the surgeons reattach them, but it's a touch and go as to whether the reattachment works. And as the movie goes on and Strickland's wandering around with this bandage on his hand and two grey then black fingers on it, the status of his fingers reflects the deterioration of his mental state. For a start, he swears and he's sexist and he's sexually harassing, and yet he claims to be a Christian man and a man of God. That hypocrisy is not unknown to us, of course. As his fingers deteriorate and as he increasingly relies on painkillers to control the pain of them, his mental state deteriorates and he goes totally off the rails. And that toxic masculinity is portrayed really well by Shannon, who's an actor that will go the distance to take his characters into madness and keep them there. And he does this again in this film very, very well. And he's the true monster in the film is Strickland. The amphibian man himself isn't the monster. And as a couple of characters say at various times, he may be a god. Not necessarily like the god in the Christian sense, but he may be a creature of supernatural powers. And the amphibian man is kind of interesting. He has chromatophores over him, so there are little pinpoints of teal blue light that play over his body at times, which may be a communication medium. He has the ability to heal people, which is kind of ironic because the monster had the ability to heal Strickland's hand had Strickland been another kind of person. But instead, Strickland's there. He wants to find out the secrets of this monster because it'll help the space race if they know more about anatomy and more about the extraordinary abilities that this creature has. And also, because it's non-human, he believes it's not a godly creature. It may be a creature of hell. So he wants to get all the information he can about it, vivisect the monster, and go on to a nicer place because they're living in Baltimore at the moment. And Baltimore is not the kind of place where a person like Strickland wants to live. I've been to Baltimore. I didn't mind it. But then I went to Baltimore in 1992. But Baltimore, John Waters' hometown, of course, didn't have a good reputation at that stage. And Strickland's attitude to it reflects that. Then we've got the complex character of Giles, played by Richard Jenkins, who he plays it very, very well. He really does give us a lot of nuance and a lot of character. One of the great character actors acting at the moment, Richard Jenkins. I like him a lot. He played comedy in Step Brothers and other movies like that. He was in Bone Tomahawk. A whole bunch of different things, and he really does give us a complicated and complex and sympathetic character in Giles, who's a really fine artist, but who is limited by the preconceptions and the prejudice of his time, as indeed are the characters of Eliza and Zelda. They're limited because Eliza is perceived as being handicapped, and Zelda is a woman of colour working in a menial janitorial role. And there is that bit in the movie where Strickland says, "Why am I talking to the shit cleaners?" Because he, when the monster is kidnapped, the last people he thinks did the job will be the cleaners. He thinks it's a Russian spies or somebody else, some kind of group of highly qualified agents who come and do this, but it isn't. It's just a couple of people who know their workplace really well and are willing to be bold and get in some help to get the job done. And that underestimating of them is one of Strickland's weaknesses. There's a lot of talk in the movie of Strickland's image of what it is to be a man. He's got a copy of The Power of Positive Thinking that he reads. He's does affirmations in the mirror to himself. He's the swinging dick and has to prove it, which means he's actually a weak person. There's a scene where Eliza and Zelda are cleaning the men's toilets and he walks in and just takes a piss while they're standing there. He to prove that, you know, they don't in any way control his actions. And that's a kind of bold move. And again, it's one of those reflections of toxic masculinity that is going to resonate really well in the future. It's going to be one of those movies where people say, that is what the problem was, and to some extent still is. And it echoes through things like the Me Too movement and the sense of entitlement in the film industry and in other industries as well that certain men have had. So that's a really strong theme in this movie. Then there's the theme of cinema as well. And Eliza and Giles live in apartments above an old school cinema, which at the time is showing the story of Ruth from 1960 and a Pabboom musical called Mardi Gras. Now, there's some resonances there too. And just to help the podcast, I've actually watched The Story of Ruth since I saw The Shape of Water. It's a movie that stars Stuart Whitman and Tom Tryon. It's about the biblical story of Ruth. And it's about a woman who is raised as a priestess of a pagan belief system, which requires human sacrifice. She meets a Jewish artisan called Marlon, played by Tom Tryon, and kind of learns the error of her ways and is seduced out of the toxic environment in which she was raised, in which she lives, to a sense of freedom in a way. This movie is pretty fucking crazy too. If you have a look at The Story of Ruth, the King of Moab is played by the guy who played Sergeant Schultz in Hogan's Heroes, John Banner. The main priest of the cult is played by Thayer David, and his offsider is played by Vivica Lindfors. This movie is kind of at the end of the biblical epic kind of thing, but the casting on it's pretty wild. You even see people like Victor Buono in a small role in there. It's really a weird film in a lot of ways, and I think it was a deliberate choice by Del Toro because some of the character arc that the character of Ruth, played by Alana Eden in The Story of Ruth, goes through parallels the arc of Eliza in The Shape of Water. Now, I haven't been able to find a copy of Mardi Gras with Pat Boone in it, and given that I don't like Pat Boone movies at the best of times, I probably won't see it. But, the fact that they're showing the story of Ruth down in the cinema, and when the amphibian man escapes from Eliza's apartment, he goes down into the cinema and is watching that movie standing in the middle of an empty cinema, because the cinema's not doing very well. And he's mesmerized by the images on the screen, which shows that love of cinema that Del Toro clearly has. The story he's seeing parallels the story of Eliza. So that's kind of cool. And to pick such an obscure biblical epic to do that with was really interesting. And I like the fact that Del Toro did that. And I'm sure a lot of people who like The Shape of Water are going to track down that movie to watch it. Don't expect too much if you do. It's very much of its time, but the casting in the movie and the acting and some of the set designs and things is pretty fucking out there. So you've got that theme of cinema as well in there. It's also a very sexual movie. We see Eliza in a number of sexual situations which are prurient. She has a ritual each morning where she puts some eggs on to boil to have for her lunch and then sits in the bath, lays in the bath and masturbates. So she's very much in touch with her own body and her own sexual feelings. And the seduction that she does of the amphibian man, yes, there is sex involved, is forthright and honest, which is kind of cool. And then there's a cool scene with her and Eliza where because the amphibian man doesn't have external genitalia, Zelda asks Eliza how sex works with an amphibian man, and she uses her hands to show how the amphibian man's penis works. And that's kind of cool as well. And she goes along with it. Eliza accepts the amphibian man, obviously, as an intelligent creature to whom she's sexually attracted and who is sexually attracted to her. And Zelda just goes, men are men, and accepts the fact that the monster is, in several important senses, a man. He's intelligent, he's upright, he's male, and he has sex with more or less human females, or at least one more or less human female. There's also a lyrical beauty and a romanticism about this film. The choice of music and the soundtrack is predominantly Alexandre Desplat, who's done a number of films. He did a couple of the Harry Potter movies and a number of other films. And he has a very kind of poetic and lyrical style about him in his compositions. He did the music for a French movie that I like a lot called Lago Winch back about a decade ago, which is worth checking out if you get a chance to. But not only do they use that, but they also use some other music. There's a version of Serge Gainsbourg's La Javanesa, sung by Madeleine Peyrou, which I like a lot. I'm a big Serge Gainsbourg fan at the best of times. And having that used in a romantic moment was kind of cool. I got the same kind of squee about that as I got when Charles Trenet's Boom is played in Skyfall. And the fact that a James Bond movie used a French chanson that I liked a lot was a squee moment for me as well. So, the music choices in The Shape of Water are pretty damn good. And to the point as well, they support and don't detract from what's going on. And they're definitely a part of the mood and the lyricism and the fantasy that is built up by this movie. Now, let's have a look at here. I'm trying to find the list of nominations this film's getting for the Academy Awards, and it's pretty important. You've got to remember, this isn't a major film. This is a $19.5 million movie, getting 13 award nominations, which is kind of interesting. It's got a nomination for Best Director. It's also nominated for Best Picture. Let's see what we've got there. Best Actress. Best Supporting Actor for Richard Jenkins. Best Actress, of course, for Sally Hawkins in there. Best Supporting Actor for Octavia Spencer, which is kind of cool. Best Original Screenplay. Let's have a look. I'm sure there are others down here down the list. Best Original Score. Best Sound Editing. Best Production Design. So 13 awards in the technical and in the acting and directing and other, and also cinematography. So basically it's getting all the important award nominations there. So it's going to win some of them. You can't get 13 nominations and not get one of those little golden guys there somewhere. And I think it's deserved. I think this movie has so many virtues to it. It's an original story, and it tells it in an original way, even though it does launch itself from The Creature from the Black Lagoon. It's a story that takes things in another area. It's a story that, even though it's set in 1962, speaks to modern concerns about a lot of different things, and it's very much a movie of the Trump era in the sense that it is a reaction against the kind of ideology that Trump represents. It's beautiful, and I think it's a new stage for Del Toro, which I really like. The fact that it's not a movie full of jump scares and horrors the way some of Del Toro's work is, and I like Del Toro a lot. I've seen all but one or two of his films. I haven't seen Crimson Peaks yet, and I really should see that. I do have a copy of it. But I think that this movie is just wonderful. I had to actually travel to see it. had to go down to Geelong, which is about 50 kilometres away, to see it because the local cinema wasn't showing it for some reason. And the only other choice is I had to go through heavy traffic to get to, but to get down to Geelong, I just have to go down the freeway and find a park. So I went to the Village Cinemas in Geelong, which is built into an old Art Deco cinema that they've redone inside to turn it into a 12-screen cinema. But outside it looks beautiful. If you go to my Instagram, go to Cult Guru on Instagram, you'll see an outside picture of the Geelong cinema. So it was a lovely cinema. Had to go right up the back to a 70-seater, a small cinema, at the back of the complex to see this film. Fortunately, I used my senior's card, so I got a very, very cheap ticket. But it was great. And even the fact that some silly woman brought a crying child, crying baby, into the cinema, she left very soon after the baby started crying. But even that didn't spoil the movie for me. It's really a lovely film. Visually, it's lovely. The characters are engaging and some of them horrifying. And even when there are the moments of horror, as Strickland goes totally off his nut, basically, there's still that strong relationship between, a relationship that really shouldn't work, between Eliza and a non-human creature who has extraordinary abilities but doesn't look like a human being. That relationship shouldn't work in a movie as well as it does in The Shape of Water. And again, all of it is propped up by the character actors and the characters they play, the music, the way that Del Toro uses lighting, and the fact that the characters don't act the way we expect them to. There's a moment in the film, and again, we're in spoiler territory, where the amphibian man eats one of Giles's cats. And we expect that to play out as a tragedy and the guy's crying about his cat and all that kind of thing. But Giles is a man who's accustomed to disappointment and to bad things happening. So he rationalizes and thinks it through and goes, yes, well, he's a wild animal. He doesn't know about cats. He was just following his nature. And he is sympathetic to this and doesn't play it the way we expect a pet owner to play something biting the head off one of his pets. Giles is a grown-up human being in that sense, and he does understand what occurred, even though as he startles the monster, it claws him, which again leads on to further plot points. But he really does react in a way that movies don't set us up to think he's going to react. How, you know, that grammar of movies and the way that we think a traditional film would play that isn't the how it's played at all. And I kind of like that. I like those reversals. I like those character moments where we can't always predict how people around us are going to react to any one thing. And that plays to our sense of verisimilitude and our sense that this is a real person rather than a character in a movie. And I really love that kind of stuff in films. As I said before, there are people who think that the character of Eliza should have been played by somebody who isn't able to speak. But I think that the job done by Sally Hawkins is extraordinary. And that's not the only part of the film. It's about so much more than that, and it includes so much more than that. And I can't wait to see what Guillermo del Toro brings us next. I think that this movie is definitely going to let him get any project he wants to make made next, and I think it's going to be a really interesting time for science fiction and fantasy cinema to follow his career into the future. So that's about it this time around. I haven't fixed the Patreon credits yet, but then it's been fucking hot, and that's the excuse I'm going with this time around, but I will get them done. So thank you for listening. Thank you again to the Patreon subscribers who are universally wonderful and kind and supportive and sympathetic beings who everybody should throw rose petals at their feet wherever they walk. I'll be back next week with another Paleo Cinema podcast, and in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I may put a Martian Drive-In related poll up on either Facebook or on the Patreon page, patreon.com/paleocinema, so that I can get a bit of feedback about how people want Martian Drive-In specifically to progress. I did do one for Paleo Cinema, and I did get some nice feedback, so thank you to all the people who put feedback on that and who voted on the choices I gave as far as the kinds of movies I'm going to run forward with on Paleo Cinema. Great stuff there, like it, and it's incredibly useful to me to have that feedback. So anyway, take care of yourselves. Watch good movies, watch bad movies. Definitely see The Shape of Water if you haven't. I'm so looking forward to seeing Black Panther when it comes out. I'm looking forward to also to Altered Carbon coming out on Netflix early next month. I hear good things about it from people I trust, like Travis Johnson. And by the way, you should look up Travis's blog, Celluloid and Whiskey, which has a lot of good things there. And you can also support him on Patreon as well. He also writes for Film Inc. and does some great reviews there, as indeed does my good friend Grant Watson, with whom I disagree on so many things, and yet we still keep talking to each other. I have to get Grant back on the podcast, I think. Anyway, take care of yourselves. I'll be back very soon. If you're down here, stay cool. If you're up there, stay warm. And enjoy the week until I talk to you again. And here are the credits. Thank you to Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris our Music Director, Jan our Dialect Coach, Armin our Key Grip, Matt our Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris the Camera Operator, Christopher the Gaffer, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy our Foley Artist, Alyssa our Location Scout, Mark our Set and Unit Director, Paul our Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy our Donut Wrangler, Tim our New York Unit Director, Rabbi Steve our Spiritual Advisor, Steve, our monster effects guy, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Richard H, the set photographer, Mark D, extra, David L, the extra, Richard C, our transportation co-captain, Carrie L, our Tasmanian consultant, and Kerry C, our accountant. We also have Sally, our continuity girl, and of course the other Sally, who is always helpful and encouraging and wonderful. So thank you very much to all of the Patreon subscribers. You too can be a Patreon subscriber by going to patreon.com/paleocinema and donating as little as $1 per month.